Welcome, everybody. I'm just kind of trying to get comfortable in my little nest here with all my cords and mics and whatnot that I have here. I'm Lyndall Johnson, one of the Sims local Dharma leaders, and I'm going to be substituting for Tim tonight. Well, he is off getting his daughter settled in college. And it's really nice to be here. It's just a little bit weird seeing everybody on the screen with Zoom and everybody here in the room. It's, I don't know. It's just a different experience, but here we are. And as I think most of you know, this year, our teaching series has been centered around the 10 Zen ox herding pictures. And these pictures give us a sense of how our meditation practice unfolds over time, but they're also good illustrations of states that we can find ourselves in over and over, no matter how long we've been on the path. And I'd just like to check, ask if there's anybody who's new to Sims tonight, to give a special welcome to you. Happy to have you here and happy to have people who come regularly too. So this week I'm going to be giving one last talk on the seventh of the ox herding pictures, ox forgotten, self alone. And Tim has already given you some great instruction on the meaning of this picture and how to work with it. And so I hope what I say tonight will be kind of a nice complement to what he has already presented, you know, kind of summing up what has already been discussed, and then maybe adding a few points that haven't been talked about too much also. But we'll begin this evening as usual with a 40-minute sit, and then I will have the talk, and then we'll have some time at the end for questions, for sharing, to give everybody a chance to maybe share what they've experienced with working with this picture over this past month. So I want to welcome everybody back. It's nice to see you here in the room in person and also on Zoom. And as I mentioned before, this evening's talk is about this seventh ox herding picture. And it's been kind of funny. I found this picture to be unusually special for me. I really, it feels to me like it's an important picture that says a lot about like a sort of a transition or turning point in our practice. So I feel lucky that Tim gave me the opportunity to speak about it today. It's been really interesting for me, and maybe it's been an interesting picture for you. So I'd like to start by putting up the picture and the poem so we all have a bit of time to reconnect with it and remember what it's like. So here is the picture. Ox forgotten, the self remains. So we see the ox herder calmly sitting in the little hut, his or her little hut. The sun is rising, surrounded by beautiful vegetation, a really quiet, calm, and peaceful place. And the ox is no longer present, nowhere to be seen. And then we have the poem. Astride the bull, I reach home. I am serene. The bull too can rest. The dawn has come. In blissful repose within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and the ropes. So taking just a few moments to contemplate on your own, letting anything come up that arises with this picture. Things it might bring up in terms of your own experience or your own practice. Mm-hmm. Okay, we can take the picture down now. So we're in the final week of working with this picture, the ox forgotten and the self alone. And as we've seen looking at it, the oxherder has reached home, is at peace, by themselves in the thatched dwelling. But I think that all of you who have been following this ox herding series will agree that getting here has been no easy journey for the ox herder, and no easy journey for us either, as we've gone through all of these different pictures and experiences. In the previous pictures, the ox herder spent a lot of time searching for the ox in all sorts of wild and scary places, difficult terrain, finally found the ox's footprints, then glimpsed the ox, and then came the task of catching the ox and taming the ox, which involved all sorts of struggle, all kinds of difficulties and work. And then finally, in the picture six, the ox herder was able to ride the ox home in a peaceful and calm and happy way. So now in the picture we're working with now, the ox herder is right there at home. So there's no more searching, there's no more catching, there's no more training, there's no more traveling, no more disciplining the ox with the whip and the rope. In fact, the ox is nowhere to be seen. The ox herder is simply quietly at home. So it's pretty clear, as Tim has pointed out in his earlier talks, that there's a really significant transition when we get to picture seven. From doing all kinds of things to being in repose and at rest, from moving and traveling to going nowhere, from discipline and training to abandoning the whip and the rope, from the ox and the ox herder together to the ox herder alone. And I think for me, this is what's most significant about this picture, is this sense of transition in how we practice, in our attitude about our practice. So how does one arrive at this place? What happens? What allows the ox herder to get here? How does this transition occur? Well, I think we might start first by just reviewing a little bit of what we know about where the ox herder actually is in picture seven. And we've talked about this picture as a stage, the stage as being a place of deep equanimity, of serenity, of repose, where the practitioner is no longer efforting to get somewhere or to make something happen, but just receiving whatever is there, whatever arises. It's been described too as a place where instead of seeking and searching, we come to stillness. And the title of this picture describes this stage as one where the ox is forgotten and the self is alone. So what might that mean, the ox is forgotten? Well, if we think of the ox as representing the spiritual path, we might think of this picture as a place where the path itself kind of disappears. And this isn't the end of the ox herding series, so there's still more to be known, but we're no longer journeying anywhere to find it. So whatever is to be known from here on out, or to be seen from here on out, is seen right here where we are. And we might also think of the ox and the ox herder as representing two different aspects of the self or aspects of the mind. You know, maybe the idea is that one of these is something that's being trained and controlled, and the other one is the part that's doing the training and controlling. Or maybe we think of it as the authentic self or the spiritual self that has all of our good qualities, and then the ego mind that maybe isn't necessarily so good and needs this training and discipline. But in this picture, there isn't any more division. This doesn't exist. Whatever the ox represents has been incorporated into the ox herder. So there's no longer this struggle between the ox herder and the ox, or what we might think of as the ego mind and the spiritual mind. There's just one. So we're no longer at war with ourselves. And picture 7 is also described in the poem as the place where the whip and the rope have been abandoned. So here we no longer need so much of this training and discipline. Things just are fine naturally as they are. So what is it that gets this ox herder to this place? Well, from what we read in some of the commentaries, it might sound as if the ox herder has reached this stage because he or she is in a really advanced stage of realization. And this certainly is a possibility. This is where the practice leads. For example, Martine Batchelor says that at this stage, we're at peace with ourselves, our mind, body, and heart, with the whole world. We do not even need to try to discipline ourselves because now the practice and the cultivation of the precepts come unheeded. Harmlessness and generosity come naturally. In this state, you cannot even think of being unkind or telling lies. Those kinds of thoughts do not arise. And in kind of a similar vein, in the book Riding the Ox Home by the Zen teacher John Dido Laurie, he talks about this stage as a place where the struggle has ended, where training is effortless, and where the ego is out of the way and we're free from grasping. So these descriptions can leave us with this kind of feeling that at this stage, maybe all of the defilements and the difficulties have disappeared, so there's only beautiful qualities of mind remaining. And with only these beautiful qualities, of course, the whip and the rope are not necessary. And we might be tempted to say that at this stage, this, you know, troublesome, what we sometimes call the ego mind, has been transcended. And so only this pure, authentic self remains. So, you know, on the one hand, this is a really inspiring description. And it can give us a beautiful vision of where our practice is headed. And it may be something we feel like we have maybe glimpsed, have a little taste of in deep meditation. But on the other hand, when we hear this, we might be equally likely to think, well, yeah, you know, maybe for some people like the Dalai Lama, but wow, this really isn't me. Like I was saying, you know, at best we might feel we've been here for a very short time, maybe during a retreat or during deep meditation, but we don't feel that we live here. This isn't our quality of mind all the time. And so we might feel like this picture represents a place that's, you know, really so far from our experience that we can't really relate to it, except maybe to hope that someday maybe we'll reach this stage too. And so we might kind of dismiss this picture and not really engage with it as fully as we could. But I think over this past month that Tim's teachings and what he has explained about this picture have suggested that maybe this stage isn't really so far away as we might think. And that maybe some of the elements of this stage and this transition that this picture represents are things we can experience right now in our own practice. Even if we aren't perfect, even if we're not always generous and we're not always kind, And even if we're still troubled sometimes by all those difficult emotions that are so much a part of being human, you know, desire, aversion, doubt, confusion, delusion, all of that whole gamut. So maybe the most important message for us right now from this picture isn't so much that eventually we reach a stage where no more effort is needed because all of our unkind and unskillful thoughts just never arise. Although, as I said, certainly, you know, the practice is headed in that direction, but more that this process of spiritual awakening isn't something that we as individuals do. It's more like something that happens to us if we're willing to show up and just look, to be still and see what arises. So maybe it's more about moving from a place where we're doing and doing and doing in our practice to a place where it's more like the practice is doing its work on us. As Martine Batchelor in her comments about the oxygen pictures also says about this stage, until now there was this idea that there was something to do, something to practice. There was a separation between ourselves and the practice. There was a dualism between what was spiritual and not spiritual. But at this stage, this begins to fall away. So there isn't so much the sense of our good or spiritual nature versus our not so good ego mind that we have to subdue and control. As the verse says, we forget the ah. Instead, it may be that we're just aware of the activities of the heart and mind, all of them, unfolding moment by moment and being known. The Columbia University commentaries, which go along with this set of pictures that we've been using, also says, in kind of a similar way, that in the seventh picture, the oxherd has realized his identity with the ox. So the ox can be forgotten. It is none other than the experience of everyday things. Until now, the ox herder has been practicing meditation as a means of achieving enlightenment. But with the realization of non-duality of existence, the practice itself is realization. So there's this quite a shift. And while we might not put it in those terms ourselves or think of it in quite that language, I think that sooner or later we too all go through this kind of transition in our own practice. And it's certainly something that our guiding teacher, Rodney Smith, talked about quite a bit. How at some point there's a shift in our way of seeing, so we're no longer so much doing the practice, progressing along a path, you know, climbing up that mountain to try to achieve some goal. And we're more just here, not going anywhere, simply receiving what arises. So we shift from a very active, efforting kind of mode to a more receptive mode. Now, Tim has talked about this transition also in terms of what falls away as we move from the earlier picture to picture 7. And I think I found this to be really helpful, so I'm going to kind of review that again, remind us of that. So he's mentioned 3 things. First, how the sense of time falls away. And some of you might remember who are more the old timers hearing Rodney talk about this too, in terms of the vertical and the horizontal axis, and how when we're moving along the horizontal axis, we're caught up in time. We're looking backward at what we've done. We're looking forward at where we're going. We're measuring our progress. We're moving toward our goals. And we're kind of living out the story of my spiritual journey when we're on this axis. But on the vertical axis, we're just there. We're not looking back to the past. We're not looking forward to the future. We're in the present, what we might even call the eternal present, just here where we are. And, you know, really, here is the only place from which the truth can really be seen. It's kind of like the poem that I read Jerrinar said, finding the path, finding your home on the path in the center of your own heart. Because if you keep searching and searching in the past and the future, the search never ends. So time falls away. And then there's doing. And as I mentioned before in these earlier pictures, there's a lot of doing. Catching, seeking, taming, all of this doing, doing, doing. But in picture number 7, the observer is no longer doing. And we may see this same kind of shift in our own practice, where we find that we're no longer trying to make something happening. We're just being present for what does happen. Finally, Tim mentioned thought. Thought falls away. Not so much in the sense that thoughts never arise, because they will. That's what the mind does, the mind thinks. But more in the sense that we're not so attached to them. We're not so identified with our thoughts. So they can just come and go. They arise and they pass. And our sense of identification with the story that our thoughts tell is released. Or maybe a good way to put this might be to say that we stop thinking so much about what ought to be happening in our practice and just pay attention to what's actually happening. I might add a few more things that fall away, and I think maybe in a way they're just slightly different kind of ways of saying or elaborations on what Tim has already mentioned. And one of them is that sense of identification with the practice. And this is very closely related to our thoughts. So we're no longer thinking all the time about where our spiritual journey is going, our progress, the techniques we need to master to get ahead, the insights we need to have, the faults we need to fix. We're not focused so much on those kind of things. That sense of identity and this being our individual project is not so much there. And then, as I mentioned earlier, that split between our spiritual self and our ordinary self, or our ego mind and authentic self, begins to fall away. So there's less this feeling that there's this bad part of ourselves that we need to discipline and control and fix, and more a sense that these different mind states, skillful and unskillful, arise according to causes and conditions. And it's not so personal. It's not something where we have to be fighting with ourselves. And finally, the split between what we think of as our meditation practice and our daily life. And so at this stage, the practice is not so much about specific activities or techniques, even though we might still find those helpful and be doing many of the same things that we've always done. But I think there's more an awareness of an attitude of, well, it's more like our attitude toward life and more a sense of awareness in all of our activities, no matter what they might be. The Burmese teacher Sayadaw Utejaniya has described this as maybe a stage where awareness becomes natural. So this sort of sense that the awareness and the attitudes embodied in our practice are part of us, not something different and special we just do when we're on the cushion. So how do we come here? What's behind this falling away and this change in attitude and view? Tim has already mentioned some things that contribute to this. And, you know, part of it is our experience in our meditation practice. Especially, I think, when we're on retreat and we have an opportunity to really practice intensively over a period of time, we can come to a state of very deep equanimity, which is like what's shown in that picture with the ox herder quiet in his little hut. You know, a place where we truly do feel at peace with ourselves, our mind, our body, our heart, and with the whole world. And where we know this is the way it is right now, and there's a sense that that's enough. Nothing else is needed. The way it is the way it is, and that's fine. And we have this experience. Now, of course, this state doesn't last forever. But just tasting it, I think, is really important because it lets us know that that kind of deep contentment is possible. And if we know what's possible, we have more of a sense that maybe we can find it, maybe not only in small times on retreat, but maybe it can be something that permeates our daily lives more than we think it might. And when we feel this deep equanimity and state and steadiness and stability, we're also really sensitive to just kind of small changes in our attitude. You know, we can really feel how any movement away from just being with what's present, any movement we make towards some better thing that we might be hoping for in the present, or some exciting thing we would like to see in the future, any kind of movement at all really only disrupts this equanimity and obscures our ability to really see clearly what's happening. And so that can be a very helpful kind of experience to have. But as Tim has suggested in his talks and exercises the past couple of weeks, we can also begin to explore this sort of state and attitude in our daily lives and bring ourselves more in line with this viewpoint through investigation and through questioning, not in the sense of figuring things out, but more with the sense of using questions as a kind of contemplation. These, you know, repeating questions like we've worked with the past week or so, we might ask ourselves questions such as, where is time in this moment? Where is equanimity in this moment? Where is stillness in this moment? Where is awareness in this moment? And when we do this and we really just kind of feel into what actually is present, we might be surprised at what we learn. You know, for example, maybe we ask ourselves, where is the future in this moment? And we find that actually that future that we're often so caught up in really only exists in our imagination. And it really isn't here in this present moment. I think that insight and wisdom that we develop through practice play a part in this process too. You know, for instance, as we continue to practice and begin to realize that what we think of as ourself isn't quite as solid as we originally thought it was. And we start to see that our thoughts and emotions are, you know, coming and going in a way that we can't control so much. And we might see that they don't really define us in the way that we thought they did. Our tendency to identify with them and identify with this whole idea of controlling begins to fade away and diminish, and with it, this sense of needing to control our practice as well. But there's one more thing that I think is especially important in bringing us to this place of transition, And it's something that's been really important for me in my own practice. And this is that we begin to realize that all of those things that we've been doing, all of those things that we do in our everyday lives when we want to accomplish something, all of that fixing, the striving, the struggling to make progress, all of that kind of work that we do just isn't working when it comes to our spiritual practice. And we really start to feel the dukkha of being caught up in these attitudes of wanting to progress and make things happen and control what happens and, you know, see this or see that that we think we ought to see. For example, we might begin to see that as soon as we start to focus on that more enlightened mind state that we would really like to get to, or that insight that we would really like to have, we feel this pain and restlessness of wanting. And we're not really satisfied with what's happening. We're not equanimous about what we're experiencing. And this does not feel very pleasant. That sense of wanting something more or different from what is happening, it is not very pleasant. You know, where's the contentment in that? Where's the equanimity in that? And if we're thoughtful about what's going on, we might also realize that when we're caught up in what we're hoping to see and what we're hoping will happen, we're caught up in our thoughts and our imagination, and we're not in the present. We're in the future. So we aren't really being mindful. We aren't seeing things clearly. We're not connecting with the present moment. And also when we feel ourselves really trying to make progress, trying to get somewhere, we may notice how this sense of self really kind of arises and solidifies. We get caught up in the story of our spiritual journey. We get caught up in worries and evaluation of our success, of our failure, and that's painful. We feel tension. We feel self-doubt. We feel discouragement and disappointment if things aren't going the way we think they ought to be. And that's a really hard place to be in. Now, for a while, when we experience these kinds of things, we don't think that it's because of our attitude towards the practice. We really don't understand that that's the problem. You know, we don't know any other kind of attitude to have except for this, you know, setting our goals, trying to make progress. We think that, you know, things aren't going as we think they ought to be going because we're not doing enough. We're not practicing enough. We're not sitting long enough. We haven't been on enough retreats. We're not trying hard enough. Or maybe there's something wrong with the techniques we're using. We have to master something more and do everything better. But at some point, I think we begin to understand what's actually going on, and that the problem is really not so much with what we're doing in our practice per se. The problem is more with our view and our attitude, that we're caught up in delusion when we're trying to make something that's not really me and not really mine and not really what I am into something that is very personal and all about us. We're caught up in our dreams and fantasies about the future, and we're not really connecting with the present. And we know that that isn't the direction we want to be going. And we know that it's a painful direction when we're going that direction. And so we begin to see that we ought to be looking at things differently. You know, in a way, what's ironic about all of this is that all along, and I think Tim mentioned this in one of his talks, is that our simple meditation instructions have really been directing us to just this place where the observer finds themselves in this picture seven, this place where we sit down and just notice what's arising in the present moment. So when we actually get to this stage of picture seven, after all of our journeying and seeking and doing, when we're actually oriented in that direction, it's kind of like, you know, after hearing those basic instructions over and over so many times, we finally understand, yeah, this is what we really need to do. And we understand why we need to do it. But of course, navigating this transition isn't easy. You know, in these observing pictures, it may look like it's very smooth and seamless journey. Very, you know, easy. But in reality, I would say not so much. At least that certainly hasn't been my experience. And I have a feeling that many of you would agree. This transition is, you know, not such an easy thing. Now, certainly the dukkha that brings us to an understanding that some shift to our approach to our practice is necessary is definitely not smooth and easy and pleasant and painful, painless. It just isn't. It's, you know, a struggle. It's difficult. And even beyond that, even when we come to that understanding, I think this transition of shifting from an attitude of doing and progressing in our practice to simply being receptive and allowing things to unfold can also be a pretty confusing time, you know, even when we sense that this is the direction we need to go. And, you know, there's a lot to get confused about, I think. You know, first, just hearing about things like the falling away of time and the falling away of doing can be quite confusing, especially if we're relatively new to the practice. And some of our confusion can be about what makes sense and is useful in our everyday, you know, lives in the relative reality, and what is true in ultimate reality and applies to our spiritual practice. So I think that it's important to recognize that a changing orientation to time and effort and doing in our spiritual practice doesn't mean that we necessarily give up all of those strategies in our everyday lives. You know, our past, our future are still there. Our personal history and history on a larger scale, those are still there. And we can still set goals and make plans for the future. And those kind of strategies, you know, may work really well for a lot of practical things, like completing projects at work or taking care of our health or saving for retirement or learning new skills or, you know, we need to do those kinds of things in our everyday life. But when we try to apply those same attitudes to our spiritual practice, it can get us into trouble. And I think even in our everyday lives, we may recognize that if we're too achievement-oriented and we're too goal-driven, we can be so focused on the outcome of what we're doing and of getting it done and having success that we forget to appreciate the process of doing whatever it is we're learning or whatever it is we're doing. And that's a big loss. That isn't a good kind of attitude to have. And also, if we're so focused on our plan and making sure it happens, we won't have the flexibility to cope when things don't go according to plan, which, you know, inevitably, that is going to happen sooner or later. So we can use our strategies of planning and goal orientation when they're helpful, but also recognizing their limitations in both our daily activities and in our spiritual practice. And it's also true that the idea of a spiritual path and spiritual goals that we're aspiring to can be really helpful and even necessary in a way to give us a sense of what this practice is really all about. And we might feel that having a kind of a roadmap of our spiritual journey, like what we see in the ox herding pictures or what we have, you know, in some of the sequences of things that happen in our own tradition, can be a big support. You know, we can recognize some of our own experiences in these descriptions. And we know because they're described by these, you know, masters and teachers, that what we're experiencing is normal. And that can be really reassuring. And we can see that the things we're doing are actually, you know, leading somewhere. And it may help us to feel that the techniques we're learning and the practices we're doing actually make sense. And all of this can be really helpful. It can build our faith and confidence in ourselves. It can build our faith and confidence in the path. So there is that really good aspect to having a, you know, a sense of a path. And yet if we get too attached to one particular idea of how things should be happening and start trying to make things happening according to what we may have heard about or read about and insisting that this is, has to be what happens according to our own timetable, well, that's just a recipe for pain. That isn't going to get us to any good place. And, you know, I think I certainly know that from having been there. And I think maybe others of us also have been there and know that. It's not a very good strategy. It just kind of backfires. And, you know, similarly, we may have a sense that it's not helpful to, you know, to just strive and strive and strive toward a goal, even if it's something that's worthy, because it brings up so much wanting and so much identification, and so much of getting there isn't really under our control anyway. And yet at the same time, we can't just do nothing. We need some sort of effort, don't we? You know, in the teachings, aren't we encouraged to cultivate the good, to make that sort of wise effort? And, you know, we definitely need to be able to recognize our unskillful impulses and to learn to do things differently. And surely we think we need some sense of aspiration. You know, after all, aren't we encouraged to aspire to awakening? So I think it can be really confusing. We begin to see that the kind of effort we've been making isn't really working, and yet what really is wise effort? What really is wise aspiration? A Zen poem, a poem by the Zen master Ryokan, provides one view on this. He says, "Too lazy to be ambitious, I let the world take care of itself. 10 days worth of rice in my bag, a bundle of twigs by the fireplace. Why chatter about delusion and enlightenment? Listening to the night rain on my roof, I sit comfortably with both legs stretched out." Now, I've always loved that image of him sitting with both legs stretched out. And yet when we read this poem, we're like, huh, well, what do we make of this? It really sounds too extreme. It sounds too lax. It might even sound dismissive of all that we're trying to work for in this practice. I mean, how can we say, you know, why even chatter about delusion and enlightenment? And yet at the same time, this poem also captures the sense that maybe it isn't so helpful to spend all this time thinking and talking about our ideas of delusion and our ideas of enlightenment. What's important is that we are here, present, right now, listening to that rain on the roof. And if we're not present, we really can't know the truth about delusion or enlightenment anyway. Or maybe some other words that might not sound quite so extreme by an unknown Zen practitioner might speak to us. This person says, be detached, be detached, be thoroughly detached. What then? The pine is green and white is the snow. So again, this idea of letting go of our ideas about anything. What should be happening? Progress we should be making? Ideas about whatever. No need for anything but just this. Or maybe this poem from the Mu Mon Khan, which is a great book of Zen koans. Spring comes with its flowers, autumn with the moon, summer with breezes, winter with snow. When useless things don't stick in the mind, that is your best season. So all of these poems suggest that at some point we need to let go of our ideas about things. Maybe even our ideas about what enlightenment is or how close we are to attaining it or what we need to do to get there and just be present for this present moment, just as it is. But that's what's important, opening up to the mystery that's just right here. And when you read these poems, I think, you know, you can feel a sense of that sense of the sacredness of the present moment. And that's an important part of what this picture 7 is pointing to. But as much as I love these beautiful and sometimes cryptic Zen poems that we've been having so many of over this last year, I think I might even be more drawn to the clear and straightforward words of the nun Bhadra on this topic from the book First Free Women. She says, in this poem that's called Lucky, you always considered yourself lucky because things seemed to work out the way you wanted. Now luck has a different meaning. Lucky to be walking a path that finds peace in the arising and passing away of each present moment, regardless of how things work out or don't. And I just love that. You know, I think this captures the spirit of picture 7 just as much as any Zen poem. You know, that here we're at a place where all of our ideas and plans for what we ought to know, what we ought to be, how things should work out, they're not really so important. And that our practice is not attaining anything in the future, but simply in the arising and passing away of the present moment. So as we work toward this stage of transition to this place of picture 7, we need a lot of patience with ourselves. We need awareness. We need to find our own balance. When we think about aspiration, maybe we can feel that it's simply that we know where our practice is going, and we need to just let that process unfold without getting too caught up in our own ideas of how it should be happening. Or maybe even less than that, maybe simply knowing, as Bhadra says, that our whole practice is in the arising and passing away of the present moment. We might feel too that some effort is required, but the quality of that effort is different from what we originally thought was the effort that we needed to exert. Not the effort to make something happen or to achieve a certain insight or mind state, but the effort to just show up, to be present. Maybe we will keep all of the same forms in our practice. Daily sitting, going on retreat, coming to, you know, the weekly Dharma talks at SIMS, all of those things. They might stay the same, not change one bit, but our attitude may be different. We aren't so much doing all these things to reach a goal somewhere out there in the future, but doing them because they help us to be present right now in the moment. They help us to be aware as best we are able, and allowing whatever arises to arise. And maybe also we can have the discernment to observe our thoughts and our behavior, to recognize those things that are unskillful, but to avoid making them into personal faults that we have to correct. Maybe we can work with them with more mindfulness, with more patience, with less self-judgment, with more of a sense of their impersonal nature. As we go through this transition, we might feel that our practice becomes very simple. And we start to appreciate the wisdom of returning always to that beginner's mind. And we begin to understand why the Zen teachers sometimes say that we sit just to be sitting. Now, there's no doubt that we, as we go through this process, we're still sometimes going to feel confused about what wise effort really is, or how we can have aspirations without turning them into goals that we strive for. I know I certainly feel that confusion from time to time, and we won't always be able to avoid getting identified with our practice or with wanting something to happen that just doesn't seem to be happening, or with looking ahead, trying to find some evidence of progress. But at least now when it does happen, we know enough so we can recognize what's going on. And we can pause, we can take a breath, and we can return again to just this present moment. So it isn't so much in this transition that our mind is so pure that no more effort is required. It's more that we realize how doing anything besides just showing up and being aware of the present moment is getting us caught in craving and delusion. And we know that's not the direction we want to go. So we stop. At this phase, we're no longer so much caught in doing, and our meditation definitely is no longer a self-improvement project. We're opening to the mystery of the deepest truth, and that's exactly where we need to be. Let's sit together for a few moments. I'd like to end with a poem by the Zen master Ryokan, another poem by Ryokan. He says, "My hut lies in the middle of a dense forest. Every year, the green ivy grows longer. No news of the affairs of men, only the occasional song of a woodcutter. The sun shines and I mend my robe. When the moon comes out, I read Buddhist poems. I have nothing to report to my friends. If you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after so many things." So thank you all so much for being here tonight and for your kind attention. And now we have some time for questions, for comments, for sharing. And if you feel moved to do this, this might be an especially good time since it's our final night with this picture. if you would like to share anything that you have been experiencing or anything you've learned over this month working with it, that would be a great thing to do too. Okay, so any questions, comments, or sharing? Maybe first from anyone in the room has anything you'd like to say. See anybody? Let's see. I'm wondering if I can see the participants here. Yeah. Okay. Anybody from our Zoom room? If you would like to say something, you can put up your little virtual hand, and then I will see that, and I can call on you, and you can unmute yourself. Anything anybody would like to? Oh, okay. Emery.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I loved your talk. I really appreciate it. There was so much there. There was so much that resonated and clarified for me. Yeah, it was just really, really beautiful, and brought up a lot about that picture that I hadn't thought about. And I could ask a bunch of questions, but I think, like, for me personally, as I sit and go through my practice, it's more and more peaceful, and I do have that sense of like it doesn't really matter what happens anymore during a sit. I just let it happen, and it's very it's not always pleasant, but that's okay too. You know, it's just like, okay, this is just where I'm at. Less control over it, less judgment of it. But I don't have that same perspective on my daily life. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like in my practice, I can have a lot of equanimity and a lot of peace and non-judgment. But where the judgment comes in is when that doesn't transfer to my what I experience as a very demanding, busy life. And sometimes it's that I do or say something that I wish I hadn't, or sometimes it's just that I'll be on automatic pilot for so much of a day that I'm like, oh, I practically missed this day because I was just so busy and lost in thought. So I'm just wondering if you have any reflections on taking this picture into daily life.
Well, I would say first that what you describe, I think everybody in our virtual room and our actual room would say, yeah, me too. I feel like that it's an area that really does require a lot of patience. And that I found that the attitudes of practice, they do slowly kind of start to seep in to the way I behave in my everyday life, but it's a really slow process. And I often too have times when, you know, I say things I shouldn't have. I lose track of the whole day because of being busy. But I think these the attitudes gradually seep in, and maybe one of the attitudes that's most helpful that starts to seep in for me is a sense of being less self-judgmental. Mm. And being able to recognize that, yeah, these things do come up and they arise, but it isn't so much all about me. It's more about this is the human condition. Mm. So that does, reminding myself of that really does help more than berating myself.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
That's Thank you. Cool. Let's see. Any other comments? Oh, yes.
Thank you. I too really, really liked your talk. So thank you very much. And I particularly liked, I guess it was the poem or the depiction of the person sitting there who was lazy with their legs sticking out. And I was just, and I think you were right. I don't know if it's, I think it's American, right? I mean, it's like we are brought up to work hard, right? You know, and to constantly strive and to better ourselves. And this notion that we would kick back and just make do with what we have in front of us and listen to the rain on the roof. It's such a antithetical, you know, it's not the way we think about how to be in the world. But I really appreciated that. And I've had a very hard week, a couple of major losses this week. And it has been interesting for me to notice how difficult that has been for people around me. It has also been difficult for me, but there is a little bit, and maybe this gets to Emery's point, there is this little bit of underneath it all, that there is this sense that there's something bigger here, that it's not just my loss, if that makes sense. And therefore it's not as devastating, I think, as it could have been. Mm-hmm. So I feel very much as like I'm about four pictures behind in terms of my own being on the path, but it's interesting to see those glimpses and to hold that kind of that alongside the sort of kicking back with our legs out and really just letting it all happen. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you too so much. Those are beautiful comments. And I think you really touched on also that part of what makes that transition so hard is that our culture is so doing driven and progress driven and success driven, that to view things any other way, it's really hard for us to even conceive of another way until we find that bringing those attitudes into our practice is so difficult and painful, we know we got to do something else. At least I think that's how it often happens. That's how it happened for me. So yeah, it is hard. And it's also really beautiful to see that in the midst of our difficulties and our losses and our struggles, of having that sense of, you know, connecting with this, this is the way things are, loss and gain. You know, that understanding is we see it a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and it just really deepens in us until it makes a big difference, gradually, little by little, permeating. So thank you. Let's see. Now, do we have announcements tonight? Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I was going to say, okay, probably we need to do announcements. But if we don't have announcements, then maybe if anybody else has anything they would like to add, there's maybe time for maybe another person. Oh, yes.
I think that something that struck me about the picture was that it was that the sun was rising. And I think a lot of imagery around rest or being lazy or not accomplishing is like at night once we've done things.
Mm-hmm.
So that stood out to me. I think I'm at a point in my life where things are kind of a blank slate right now. And there's part of me that feels like I need to go seize the day or do something about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that speaks to me, especially, yeah, seeing a lot of people in my life that do kind of aspire to rest at night, where it's once they've done the work, once they've whatever project it is that can get them to rest instead of just starting out at the beginning of the day or wherever we are. So that spoke to me.
That's a really interesting observation. I don't think I've heard anybody talk about that aspect of the sun of being like in a state of serenity and repose when the sun is rising instead of in the evening after having accomplished everything you need to accomplish for the day. But I really like that. That's a beautiful thought, and I think it really emphasizes the distinction of being in this state of repose and state of receiving, even at a time when we normally would feel like we need to be very, very active. So, yeah, that's interesting observation. Thank you. Let's see. Well, maybe this is a good time to finish our evening. I don't see any hands just waving. Desperate things. So maybe this is a good time to finish our evening with a few minutes of just sitting together. And since we don't have announcements or anything, we have a few moments. So we can just go back into our repose and quiet for a few moments.